The U.S. Poet Laureate takes a bow. From SDPB, today is Friday, May 2nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Ada Limón's tenure as Poet Laureate has come to a close. Appointed in 2022, Limón joined In the Moment when one of her signature poetry projects was released as an anthology by Milkweed Press. We will revisit that interview as we eagerly await the announcement for the next Poet Laureate. Plus, Limón's book asks for Americans to pay close attention to the natural world. So we bring you the story of some Badlands park rangers whose close attention changed our understanding of the scientific record. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In 2022, Ada Limón became the U.S. Poet Laureate. Her tenure has drawn to a close. I spoke with Limón about a year ago. We discussed part of her signature project, the poetry anthology You Are Here. In it, she asked readers to pay deep attention to the natural world. You Are Here is published by Milkweed Press out of Minnesota. Limón and I began by talking about Milkweed Press and the power of a small Midwestern house in shaping the literary interests of America.
They've been a really beautiful press to work with. My first book with them was Sharks in the Rivers, and it came out in September of 2010. Wow. So we've had quite a long relationship. My second book with them was Bright Dead Things, which was 2015, which was the book that was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, a National Book Award, and the Kingsley Tufts. And so that book kind of hit the ground running, if you will. It was sort of my first book that received any kind of major attention. And then I stayed with them, and we did The Carrying after that, and then The Hurting Kind. You know, when it came to doing an anthology with the Library of Congress for the signature project You Are Here, it just made sense to stay with not only a press that feels very near and dear to me in terms of its people and its staff and, you know, its incredible editors and publisher, but also because of its list and its dedication to environmental justice, talking about indigenous wisdom. I'm thinking about the incredible book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which is also on that list, and its dedication to indigenous wisdom and the ecological practices of our time. And so I think it made sense to stick with the press that has such a beautiful mission, as well as just really beautiful human beings behind each of their books.
I was listening to your conversation also in Minnesota with Krista Tippett for On Being, and you were talking about The Hurting Kind and the pandemic. And during the pandemic, there was this time when everybody stayed home across the world and wild creatures retook wild spaces in the middle of the city. You know, foxes were down the street and dolphins were in canals, and everyone was reporting on what they had seen. And so it strikes me that You Are Here is also a response to the pandemic in some ways. It is different maybe than it would have been if we had not gone through that collective time together. Because now it seems to me that we've just gone back to even more of a frenzy of hurrying and rushing than we were before. And we are careening in this climate crisis at the same time. So tell me a little bit about the anthology and what you wanted to invite other poets to express to you when you were asking them to send in poetry for the collection.
That's a really wonderful question, because I think one of the things that I'm very aware of, and maybe we all are feeling on some level, is that, you know, we went through the pandemic and we isolated, and we had this moment where many of us had the privilege to stand still. You know, we thought of it as being a burden, but in many ways, there were so many first responders and essential workers that not only were not standing still or taking a breath, but were in fact working harder than they ever had in very precarious situations. And so some of us had the opportunity to stop, whether that was just to, move our work online or to actually just take a moment to recognize where we were in our lives. And I think one of the biggest things that came out of that for me was that idea of interconnectedness, that in a deep isolation, my husband was often traveling, so it was just me. I really recognized that I was never alone, that I was part of this planet, and that my daily routines were taking place with the birds' daily routines, with the plants' daily routines. My seasons were interconnected to everyone's seasons, whether we were going through an ice storm here in Kentucky or if we were suddenly going through spring and everything was out and loud and chaotic and, humming along. And I think one of the biggest regrets that I have collectively is that I don't think we took a moment to transition in any way once the pandemic lessened and, our cases went down and people returned to quote unquote normal. Because I felt like we, first of all, didn't grieve. I don't think we grieved our great losses. And I also don't think we spent time recognizing a real big question, which is, what do you want to leave here and what do you want to take with you from this experience? And I think for me, it was the importance of slowing down. It was the importance of rest. It was the importance of awareness and attention and that deep commitment to our interconnectedness that felt like I really wanted to hold on to. And what I wanted to leave was that urge for everything to be going at a pace in which we can't keep up with, for everything to be moving at a speed which not only is driven by the hedonic treadmill, for pleasure and more, but also driven by our need to procure and to make, and for everything that we do to be measured by productivity. And so I needed to make a book that really recognized that, to come back to what is a new nature poem for this moment right now? To have gone through the pandemic, luckily, I came out of it okay, and many of us did. Then to also be at this new moment where we're recognizing with more clearer eyes than ever where we are in terms of the climate crisis. We can't go back to the same nature poem that we might have studied in graduate school or undergraduate, some of those beautiful, romantic poets, whether it was Wordsworth or even Larry Levis talking about stars, or even some of our, more contemporary poets. I think even Mary Oliver, whose poetry I love, we often can't go even back to her, because we've got to move forward in a way where our poetry reflects where we are, not just as artists, but as people living on this planet at this moment and responding to it with our whole heart and our whole mind, with an openness that is receiving our reality.
You get to talk to climate scientists too, as you work on the poem that opens the National Climate Assessment Report. And they told you something similar, as I understand it, in the sense that they did not want whatever you did for them to be something that looked backward or was nostalgic. What did you learn from them about what they wanted, what scientists wanted from you as a poet and from poetry?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Doing the poem for the National Climate Assessment was really one of the great honors that I've had in the last couple of years. And, when I met with those climate scientists, one of the biggest things was that kept coming up over and over again was that it's really about mitigation and adaptation. It's not necessarily about a returning. That doesn't mean that there can't be regeneration and repair work, but it really is about mitigation and adaptation. How do we move forward? How do we move forward together? And how do we take this new reality and do the best we can for all of us on the planet, not just those of us in the United States, but everywhere on this earth, and not just the human animals, but all of the living beings. That was the biggest thing for me, was that it's no longer about returning to where we were, but instead about really recognizing our new reality and moving forward in a way that is smart, and also in a way that's clear-eyed and wholehearted.
I want to ask you about form as a reader. When you're reading a poem and you're following the narrative and it's speaking to you, and maybe you hear some words that are rich in your ears or that feel good to read aloud, but then you're at that next level where you say, I don't understand the white space here. I don't understand why she used these line breaks. And I know enough to know that maybe this is a form, but I'm not going to recognize what it is. How do you read poetry when you're at that point and you want to learn a little more and understand a little more deeply about how it is crafted so eloquently, but you don't even know where to start because you're not going to necessarily take a master's level, poetry class? Does that make sense as a question, to you that has an answer?
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful question, because I think that beyond the sort of first interaction with poetry, where you think, oh, okay, I'm gonna sort of try to understand this. And I think when we think about understanding, we have to stop thinking about understanding necessarily with our structured brain, but instead to absorb poetry the way that we might absorb walking into a forest, or the way that we might hear music. That there will be things that we don't understand, and there will be things that do make total sense to us. And we can pay attention to both of those things. If you are at a place that you really are receptive to poetry already, you enjoy it, you like reading it, but you're still kind of like, oh, how do I go deeper? How do I maybe teach myself to read this on a different level, or to expand my own horizon when it comes to the poetic form? The first thing to do would be to recognize how it makes you feel. And to sit with that, go, oh, okay, this is how it's making me feel. Oh, this is interesting. And then to also look for patterns. The patterns are sometimes what we notice in nature, and they're also the same things that we'll notice in poems when they sort of come to the surface, whether a word is repeated, whether a sentiment is repeated, whether there is some sort of line break that keeps happening, whether it's couplets or tercets, or happening in twos or threes, if you want to be put it more plainly, to look at patterns and then to think about what that intentionality might be around those patterns. That's a nice way to enter the poetic form. But above all, I would really want people to receive it the way they receive music, which is really with our hearts and our feeling center versus our analytic center.
I spent a lot of time with your poem Obedience this weekend and found it to, and maybe you can say more about this, but the way it was affecting me physically indicated to me that I was grieving the loss of my dog, or I was feeling, who died, before the pandemic. So the things that can come up for us when we spend a certain amount of time. So thank you for that poem, first of all. When you see that grief coming up, or you feel that joy or that laughter or that recognition where you rush out and you want to read it to someone else, what do you do with that when it's showing up in your body?
I think that's a really important point that you just made, is that I can have an intention around what I write. And I do have an intention around what I write, what I make. Everything's thoughtfully wrought, if you will. But then when I hand it to someone else, when you're sitting alone and reading that poem, Obedience, for example, which is about my dog is snoring next to me at the moment. She's a 13-year-old pug. That poem becomes yours now. And whatever is happening in your body, whatever you're holding onto, whether it's in your chest or what you have been receiving or holding, that's going to affect how that poem is for you and how you respond to that poem. And that's one of my favorite things about the exchange of the poem once I've written it and you receive it, is that the poem then is yours. And it's your job to let your body react to it however you want. And that kind of enthusiasm and release and kind of an energetic exchange, if you will, I think is really important to the art form itself, is that at some point it's no longer mine, but it becomes yours. And it becomes about your dog be enters it, right? Your grief enters it. And that is so beautiful because it's like I've made a forest and you've gotten to walk into it. And everything that you've carried with you is with you in that moment of stillness.
To the point when you pick up your dog in the poem, my dog couldn't be picked up. So when you said it was a pug, I was like, oh, that does make sense now. Because it occurs to me that in my mind, I was like, how would that happen? Because I had internalized it that much, that it would not have been super easy to scoop her into my arms because she was slightly bigger than your dog. So I love that. That's so delightful. I just made that
Oh,
connection.
thank you for sharing that with me. I love that too. And that's how I relate to poems, is that there is a level where it feels deeply personal. And so enough so that sometimes when you hear a writer talking about their poems, you think
That's
that's
wrong.
not the poem. That's wrong. I know how that poem is. And so I think that that is also it's not talked about enough when we talk about poetry. Is that beautiful magic moment where my work ends and the reader's work begins.
In order to get to that point, you had to say at some point that that poem was ready for the transfer. And I'm sure you get asked a lot, how do you know when a poem is done? Because this is one of the things that poets struggle with. But if you never say that it is ready to share, then I never get to have that moment, and Milkweed never publishes your book, and you never, you know. So at some point, you have to make that step. How do you think about, how have you thought about that throughout your career as a poet? And how do you think about it now, that moment when you say this is enough, or this is done, or this is ready, or however you think about it?
It changes, I think, with each poem, and each poem has different signals it sends you. But for the most part, I know when it's done is when I read it out loud many times, and I feel like the music is working in tandem to lift up the images and any kind of internal work that's happening on the page. So it's really about that auditory experience for me when I read it out loud, that it feels like every line is supposed to be where it's supposed to be. And not every poet is like this, and not every poem for me is like this. But oftentimes I'm also looking for, does it make a kind of pulsating sense? I don't mean like sense like a paragraph or prose, a meaning that I know. And there are many poets that would maybe work against meaning a little bit more, but oftentimes I'm not doing that. I'm trying to look for a type of clarity that explains something that I could not explain in prose. And if I read it out loud enough, then eventually I think, oh, okay, there's nothing more to go in it, and there's nothing more to take from it, and it's complete. So I think of it less about being done and more about it being complete or whole.
I love that. You mentioned the forest that I get to walk through, and you say in the introduction of "You Are Here," in order to have one tree flourish, we must plant more around it. The same must go for poems. And you've invited people with this prompt to create their own work. Tell us a little bit about that as part of your Poet Laureate project.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, for my signature project called You Are Here, there's two elements of it, and one of them is this anthology, which includes 50 original contemporary poems that are new nature poems, if you will, by incredible writers. And then the next part is the I'll be visiting seven different national parks around the country, and there'll be seven different poetic installations in each of these national parks. And I get to go visit them and unveil these poetic installations, and then also encourage people on each of the installations. It says just a very simple prompt. It says, "What would you say to the landscape around you?" So I'm encouraging people to write their own poem. And if poetry is really intimidating to you, there's a reason I said don't. You can write a poem, but you can also, what would you say? Is to really respond to the natural world wherever you are. And it could be that you live in a very urban space. I lived in Brooklyn for years, so I'm very familiar with finding nature in urban spaces. And it could be that you live in a more rural area. And for me, each one provides a different kind of connection. So if you can find something to pay attention to and respond to it with writing your own poem, that I think that would be a beautiful way to connect to the wonder of this world. So I've encouraged anyone, if they want to, over the summer or any time, to write their own "You Are Here" poem. They can share it if they want with a hashtag "You Are Here Poetry." They can put it on social media, but also I know social media can be a disaster, so they can also share it with their friends and their loved ones and read it to a tree or set it in their burn pile and know it once existed. Whatever it is that does your heart the most benefit. But the big thing is to pay deep and close attention to the world around you, because paying attention is also a way of loving.
Would you read something for South Dakota today? I would greatly appreciate that.
I would love to. And I want to add that in all my travels, and I've traveled a lot as a writer, as a poet, and especially in this current role as the poet laureate, I want to add that I've never been to South Dakota. So if anyone wants to invite me to join you in South Dakota, I would come, because I have never been. And so I need to check that off my list.
We are on it. We are on that so quickly and enthusiastically.
Beautiful. I will, because we talked about it, I would love to read Obedience, if that's okay with you.
Thank you. I would love that.
Obedience. The dog lifts her head from the piles of dead leaves, and at first she is calm until she is not. She can't find me, not behind the cypress or the still bare viburnum. Betrayer, I am watching from the window, warm behind the door frame. What is it to be wholly loved like this? God, how desperate she is to find me. Walking toward her, I watch her whole body vibrate when I come into focus. I lift her into my arms because it is what I want. Who doesn't want to hold their individual God, to be redeemed by pleasing the only one you serve?
That's our May 2024 conversation with then U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limón. She read us her poem, Obedience. I've had the pleasure of speaking with several poet laureates. You can find those conversations on our website, sdpb.org/news. Look for Ted Kooser, Tracy K. Smith, and Joy Harjo. I am eagerly watching for who is named to the post next. I hope you are too. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Once a tiny, as in cat-sized, deer roamed the prehistoric Great Plains. When it died, it became part of the abundant fossil story that helps define what we now call Badlands National Park. Around 32 million years later, an intern discovered and properly reported the skull of this individual deer. It was different from the others on record in really important ways. And that is how park rangers Madison Schriro and Ed Welch began documenting a tiny deer with big implications for the scientific record. Madison Schriro is a former Badlands park ranger and a geologist and paleontologist. I spoke with her in May 2024 after she co-published a paper on the new deer. Take us back to 2016 and how the discovery itself unfolded.
Yeah, so one of our geoscientists in the park's interns here at Badlands was out exploring in the park on her first day, of course, because that's how it always goes. Somebody finds something really cool and amazing on their very first day. And she found this cute little teeny tiny skull that can fit in the palm of your hand. And she did the exact right thing. She left it where it was, took photos, got coordinates, and reported it to the rangers, who passed that on to the paleontologists. Then that specimen was excavated by our paleontologists here at the park, and then taken back to our fossil preparation lab on site in the Ben Riffle Visitor Center, and beautifully prepared by one of our paleontologists there. And as she began to carefully remove the rock and the sediment from the skull, we began to realize that this thing really doesn't match up to the skulls of the other types of ancient deer we have seen before here at Badlands. So that's what kind of led us into the idea to research this in the first place.
And then you think, this is exciting, and oh no, there is a lot of work ahead of me.
Yeah, exactly.
So first of all, Tiffany, who is the intern who discovers this, like, what does she, it's never going to get better than that, maybe.
First day.
You can go
finding
home
something
now.
Amazing.
Yeah. All right, so what are some of the ways that you knew it was special? How was it different from what was already on record?
Yeah, so we looked at this skull, and the teeth told us that it was it belonged to this species called Leptomeryx ellisae, and that was defined back in 2002. But previously, that species was only known from lower jaws, lower teeth. Nobody had ever seen a skull before. So we're sitting there thinking, oh, great, we've got the first skull. Let's write this thing up. Let's describe it. Let's get it into the written record so people have access to it and can research it further if they so choose. And that's when things started to get complicated, of course, because the original idea was that we would either synonymize this species with another one that already exists. We say, oh, the differences in the teeth are actually individual variation and not indicative of, you know, a whole new species because the skulls are the same. Or we'd take a look at the skull and be like, that's totally different. So we are going to verify that it is its own species. But what we didn't expect was that the skull would be so different that we would have to make it its own new genus. Basically, what happened was the teeth look very similar to a genus of deer that we do see in the fossil record at Badlands called Leptomeryx. But the skull, the anatomy of the skull aligned perfectly, not perfectly, but very close to this genus that comes 10 million years later in the Miocene period called Pseudoparablastomeryx, which is a mouthful of a name. So suite of like kind of intermediate characters, teeth from one genus, a skull that looks like another. So since it aligned with nothing, we had to make it its own new genus.
So then that brings the question, you're not going to find hundreds of these skulls around the Badlands, or is it a evolutionary bridge between one and the other? Like, what are some of the questions that you have now that you know the things that you do know?
Yeah, I think kind of the most important question we ended up with after we kind of concluded this paper and published it was that there are a lot of other species of these tiny deer that have been described in the past from only the teeth. We find their teeth quite commonly, actually. We just don't see the skulls for whatever reason. And so now we're kind of like reevaluating all of them and searching across different paleontological collections, looking for other skulls to add to our data set. Because we are realizing that when you define things based on just the teeth with these little deer, it's not necessarily going to tell you the whole story. Yeah. Our Leptomeryx ellisae example that used to be defined from just the teeth, it does, if you look at just the teeth, it does belong to that genus Leptomeryx. But once we found the skull and it looks like this totally different genus from 10 million years later, we begin to realize, you know, that's not the case. So we're realizing that the using just characters from the teeth is kind of a flawed practice. So we're hoping to be able to find more skulls in the field or in collections that haven't been described yet and kind of add to our knowledge.
Tell us about the name, because this is one of the exciting parts of making a discovery, is that you get to help figure out how we're all going to refer to it, how scientists are going to refer to it in the future.
Yeah, so we brainstormed a while for that perfect name, you know, because it's not every day that you get to name something. So we were, of course, super excited about that. And we eventually landed on the name Santusi Merix, which means Santusi's ruminant. And we named it in honor of our good friend and colleague, Vincent Santusi, who is the senior paleontologist for the National Park Service. He actually got his start in the Park Service here at Badlands, and his master's thesis research is on the same area of the park that this tiny deer came from. So we thought this was like the best way we could think of to honor him. He's always been a huge supporter of the paleontology program here at Badlands and also for the Park Service in general. So we just wanted to give him a huge shout out from a park that he feels, you know, very connected to.
All right. So you said ruminant, and that makes me want to ask you about how this deer would have lived. What was its environment like? How did it eat? Did it travel in herds? Like, what do we know and what do we not know about what its life would have been like?
That's a great question. So 32 million years ago here at Badlands and in this area, we know that we would have been in kind of what they would call a distal floodplain setting where there are these, you know, braided river channels kind of meandering. It's kind of transitioning from more of a woodland into more of an open woodland or scrubland, working our way towards evolving the grasslands ecosystem for the first time. So there's a good amount of plants and trees, but not too densely packed. And this little teeny tiny deer is probably roaming around. We aren't, you know, too sure about any terms of behavior in terms of like whether they were parts of herds or roamed more individually. Deer today, of course, you see them usually in herds, but our little deer is probably most closely related to the living group called the chevrotains, and those are in Southeast Asia exclusively, I believe. And they have, you know, I think they tend to roam individually more often than in herds. So tough to make any sort of determinations on behavior for this guy beyond the fact that we do know that it was a herbivore, so eating mostly plants out here. When an area is good at producing fossils, such as the Badlands, you're usually either good at preserving animal fossils or plant fossils, not usually both. So we mostly have animal fossils here at Badlands, but we do have some plants material, mostly in the form of hackberry seeds. Teeny tiny fossilized seeds. So we have some leafy plants that these guys could have been eating, stuff like that, as well as some grasses.
Help us understand how you had to present your research, because it's not just what you think, it's what you can prove. You have to document evidence, you have to present it to other scientists for publication. Tell us a little bit about that process for you and Ed.
Absolutely. So we went to different paleontology collections. And we measured a bunch of teeny tiny teeth and as many of these little skulls as we could find to compile a convincing data set. That was kind of the first step. And then we started writing down our findings, you know, creating essentially a case for why this should be its own genus because it doesn't fit with anything else. Then we started writing the paper. And at the same time, we submitted an abstract, which is just like a short 300 words or less summary of your research. We submitted an abstract to a national geology conference and it was accepted for a presentation. So we actually got to travel to Pittsburgh to present at the Geologic Society of America conference, which was a great way to get the research out there before it had been published and get some feedback from our peers. And then we finished writing the rest of the paper, presented it actually a couple more times at a few other conferences, including the South Dakota Academy of Science conference, which the South Dakota Academy of Science is the journal that we ended up publishing in. Finished writing up that paper, made some figures, and then went into the peer review process. So other scientists, other paleontologists read through our paper, gave us feedback, and we incorporated that and then submitted it to the journal to get it out there.
And you're that kid who was walking around in elementary school and saying, I want to be a paleontologist someday. And if you could go back and talk to that kid now, what would you tell her about her future in science?
She would be so excited. I've literally, since I could like walk, I was telling people that I wanted to be a geologist and a paleontologist when I grew up. And
yeah.
I went to school for geology, so I felt like I had accomplished that one. But publishing this paleontology paper was huge for me. It was such a huge accomplishment because it made that, you know, little inner child in me like just freak out. Yeah. Like I did it.
Yeah. Okay. So I can imagine you like sketching this little deer in your, you know, 3-ring binder, loose leaf paper notebook or whatever. What would you have named it back then?
Oh my gosh. Back then I wouldn't come up with such a fancy name. Oh man. I would have named it something really weird probably.
let's wrap up with this idea of like back in the beginning, we said, Tiffany, is it Leone? I don't know how to pronounce Tiffany's last name.
Tiffany Leone.
Leone. Did the responsible reporting. So for all the citizen scientists who are looking and keeping their eyes open as they travel the Badlands this summer, let's leave them with some tips on if you find something really cool, what is the thing that you have to do to make sure this kind of science can be done for the scientific record and you're not damaging, destroying, or taking, God forbid, the things that you find? What would you leave us with?
Yeah, thank you so much for circling back to that. We always try to emphasize that here at Badlands because you never know how much just one fossil can tell you. I mean, this one fossil turned into a whole paper. So what you should do when you're out here in Badlands, we actually have an open hike policy, which means you're allowed to hike off trail here as long as, you know, you keep your own safety in mind and you can make sure to get back to your vehicle. We don't want to come rescue you or anything. Yeah. But if you're out there exploring on or off trail and you see something that you think might be a fossil, no matter how big or small, go ahead and leave it exactly where it is. Take photos. If you include an object for scale in the photo, any common object like a pencil, a water bottle, a coin, something like that, that's super helpful. And then if you take photos of the surrounding landscape to show our paleontologists what the area looks like, that's helpful as well. And then getting GPS coordinates for your find. You can either do that by kind of dropping a pin on a map on a smartphone, or I like to just pull up my Compass app and take a screenshot. So it's all in my camera roll, one right after another.
All right.
And then you can come down to either of our visitor centers and report that find in person, or you can email those finds to badlands_fossil_finds@nps.gov.
We will put that information up on our website as well. Madison Schriro, it's so fun to talk to you. Looking forward to the next conversation and the next discovery. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Always great to chat with you.
That's Madison Schriro. She's a geologist and paleontologist. She was a park ranger with Badlands National Park. Learn more about her work on Instagram. Her account is @geosplore. GEOSPLORE. Right now, SDPB needs to bolster our resources and prepare for the future. One of the ways you can help us is by making your gift now. Shoring up support for local stations across the country is incredibly important right now. Today, we are in the middle of public media giving days. That means public media nerds across the nation are rallying together and supporting their local public broadcasting stations, just like here, SDPB. Join the national movement and make your important donation at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963. I'm Lori Walsh here in the studio with In the Moment producer Ellen Kester.
SDPB is a place where everyone has an equal opportunity to share, learn, and get involved. Your important donation keeps this vital space open to everyone. Please protect respectful dialogue, captivating storytelling, and distinct perspectives by giving at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963. Giving might seem simple, but the effects are profound. Your dollars power what you rely on each and every day. Please join the effort and make the next story and conversation possible at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963.
There is so much to say about the importance of community-focused media right now. SDPB offers you the space to talk with your neighbors, to connect over the latest news, to enjoy the conversations you're hearing right now and in the moment. This is a community-focused station, and your support is essential. We are so grateful for all that you have done. Please make an affordable gift now at sdpb.org/donate or give us a call 605-443-6963.
SDPB is facing a lot of uncertainty right now. Your gift will help ease that. Public media faces challenges because national funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is under threat. These cuts could affect the public media at large, including SDPB. If you haven't given, we are making a special appeal to you. You're the future of SDPB. Protect the news and stories for future generations. Please make your affordable donation at sdpb.org/donate or please call 605-443-6963.
Now, we have always relied on you, and right now your gift can support the significant positive effects we have on the community at a critical time. You are why we exist. Please protect public media with an affordable gift at sdpb.org/donate.
Protect what you love. As you're going about your week listening to SDPB, it's easy to think, SDPB will always be there. They don't need my help. Listener donations are the only thing that keeps us here. Even though you don't get a bill from us, your dollars make SDPB great. Please give an amount that works for you at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963.
So the money you help us raise right now during this hour, during In the Moment, that is an important part of protecting SDPB in the months and years to come. The potential federal funding cuts will affect us. You can help alleviate some of that concern about federal funding with your monthly donation right now. Sustaining ongoing support is vital to the future of SDPB. Please give at 605-443-6963.
You'll be doing more than donating when you give. You'll be showing support for accurate news, lovely storytelling, and insightful conversations, like the ones you hear on In the Moment. SDPB is worth protecting, and you can do that with your powerful gift right now. Please make your gift at sdpb.org/donate or call 605-443-6963.
And please give what works for you in your life. Whether you give monthly or make a one-time gift, any donation will help us face uncertainty from a place of strength. Your support helps sustain and protect SDPB's future. Please give at sdpb.org. Without your help, SDPB wouldn't be here each day with insights and perspectives about your community and your world. Please make your gift right now, sdpb.org/donate.
Thank you for doing so much for SDPB and our community by making your gift. You're keeping this independent news service going. You're protecting the shows that are part of your daily routine. And that means you understand the role SDPB plays in your life. You are amazing. Yes, you. I am talking to you. You are amazing. And your hair looks amazing today as well. Thank you for your gift at sdpb.org/donate or when you call 605-443-6963.
And if you don't have hair, you look amazing without your hair right now as well.
Inclusive All right. storytelling.
We are going to wrap up this hour, of course, but please take the time right now to make your impactful gift at sdpb.org/donate. The phone number one more time, 605-443-6963. You have done so much for us in the past during our fight over state funding, and now we move to the federal level. We need you to stick with us here. The things that you come to expect from SDPB will continue to be here. Local news, insightful conversations, engaging storytelling, but it is going to take all of us working together in the same direction. Thank you for support. Thank you for protecting public media here in South Dakota, and thank you for listening. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngman. I am your host, Lori Walsh, and from all of us at SDPB, we thank you for listening.